Accession number 27202, Colonel James Dowson, Real 6. We're talking about how you got on with the other ranks. I thought you implied that you had problems with leadership. I mean, were you able to lead these few other ranks that you had under your control? Or
I suppose we managed, but it wasn't like the kind of, you know, there wasn't the kind of hierarchy of respect that normally goes with good leadership.
You mean you got on all right?
We got on all right.
Over familiar.
But not so much over familiar as under effective in getting them to do things that I wanted them to do.
So that you liked them, but they wouldn't necessarily do what you
no,
did?
No, they would take liberties with me, I suppose. Nevertheless, the relationship was okay.
We got happy enough.
Oh yes, yes.
And what sort?
I had a friend who was a pharmacist. He was a chap from Birmingham, and he, being sort of university educated, got on well with him. And I remember there was an all ranks club, which was the Salvation Army, which was just opposite. The access road to the School of Infantry, and we used to go up there and play darts and show halfpenny and so on in the intervals or in our free time, and smoke what there was, which was Capstan full strength or Park Drive. Terrible stuff. And that time I started smoking.
I don't know whether smoking was particularly realised to be dangerous then. But
no, it wasn't.
What about smoking? I mean, why did you start? I mean, was the army part of what started you? Or?
Yes, I think so. It was just, you know, one did it. It's the kind of thing you did. People would offer you cigarettes and you say, no thanks, I don't smoke. And then eventually you thought, oh, what the hell, you have a go at it. So
did you take to it straight? Because some people are just sick the first time.
No, I think I felt a bit sort of swimming in the head and so on. Same as the hangover. You know, you get used to it. And then eventually you get the bad things vanish, and the benefits, the imagined benefits, or no, the real benefits.
What are the benefits?
It's a social activity, smoking. It also has gives you the impression that you think more clearly and calmly. Whether it's just because you choose a period of reflectiveness or not, I don't know. Certainly it has a neurological effect, and I know that now. But at the time, I suppose its real function is that it gives you time to reflect on things, and so it's an imposed period of calm before you actually do something.
Now, you were running the sick bay. Was this just cut knees, scrape knees and things, or were there more?
Oh no!
The School of Infantry.
I saw one of the most serious diseases I've ever seen there, although we didn't know it at the time. And now there's a bit of sort of Schadenfreude, I suppose, in it that Captain G was the one who misdiagnosed it. A Caribbean soldier, regular soldier, came in and. He had a rash, and he was poorly. And Captain G thought that this rash was scabies. And we painted this fellow all over with benzyl benzoate, which was the treatment for scabies at the time. And it was secondary syphilis, which is highly infective.
So that was the misdiagnosis actually put you at some risk.
Yes, a bit.
But it didn't spread.
No. It's one of those things where if the lesions are weeping, and then you can probably get it through that sort of contact. But generally speaking, although it's infective in that sense, it's usually you don't get it unless there is the intimate physical contact, which is the normal way of getting it.
Was there any treatment of syphilis at the time?
Yes, he would be treated with penicillin, and was. He was whisked off and treated. We never saw him again. But
and you'd get better? Or would
At that time, he would be treated and would get better. Syphilis still is very responsive to penicillin.
Was VD generally, I mean...
Almost never talked about. it's one of those strange things that although I talked to you about my national service and all that sort of thing, there was a film about VD, that's all we were ever shown. We marched in, sat down, army film unit, showed a film about VD, and that was it. No one was ever given any further instructions.
But I mean, almost the treatment of it. I mean, because I would have thought of the School of Infantry with a large number of troops, there would be a fair number of cases of VD.
Yeah.
Or was that not the case?
I mean, I can't recollect.
So this case of
dealing Sidus, with,
which came from outside, obviously, was
yes.
the only one you really remember. Not so much
the only one I remember. People never ever recollect seeing anyone with gonorrhea, and that's something which is very visible once you've got it.
Anything else happened there? Any other interesting, you know, cases that came up, or was it just, you know?
I'll tell you something now before I forget. When I was there, the avenue that I spoke of had some small saplings that were just slightly taller than me on each side of the road. And when my son went there, the platoon commander's instruction, we went up in the car, and I didn't recognize the place. I thought, this is funny, it doesn't look the same as it used to. There was an avenue surrounded on each side by mature horse chestnut trees that arched over the top, and these are the self-same saplings that were there when I was there. And it was really very chastening to look at them and realize, my, how you've grown, you know.
So, no other interesting case. Were there any, because they do exercises, isn't there?
Yes, there were exercises. There were one or two people who were perhaps were seriously injured. What they did was that we evacuated them very quickly. You know, they were, I don't remember putting a Thomas Splint on anyone, but they were sent by ambulance to Tidworth Military Hospital, which was the nearest one.
So you were very much just a sick bay?
Yes.
Dealing with the minor
That's right.
cuts and bruises
yes.
of life?
Yes. And we still used sulfonamides, because I remember someone coming up with a rash, which I later learned was a sulfonamide rash due to sensitivities of sulfonamides, and very poorly.
I'm not quite sure what sulfonamides are there.
Sulfonamides were the substances used to kill germs before penicillin and antibiotics. They were a chemical derivative of aniline dyes, actually. It was discovered that aniline dyes would kill bacteria, and then in Germany, the firm of Bayer, it synthesized aniline dyes that were less toxic, and eventually came up with one which they called Prontosil rubrum, and which could be administered without killing the subject and kill all the germs. And then it developed, M&B, May and Baker in England, developed one which they called by the number 693, M&B 693. And that was discovered because of organic chemistry. You can have whole families of chemicals. And gradually they were improved. But they still had the problem that some people were essentially allergic to them and became very poorly. And we saw one or two cases like that because we still used sulfonamides routinely when I was there.
Were they? When did it phase out? I mean, did penicillin take over entirely? Or?
Well, penicillin and antibiotics, with the introduction of streptomycin, the range of activity of antibiotics was extended, and so the use of sulfonamides became less important. And also, with all of these things, where you simply go in and kill the organisms, eventually the organisms learn to be resistant to it, so sulfonamides became less and less effective. So it was evolution rather than revolution.
Anything else about your time at Warminster?
Yes, there was. I got friendly with the dental orderly. I've forgotten his name now, but he had a motorbike. And he lived in Birmingham, and because we were friendly, we both went around on this motorbike. I tried riding a motorbike when I was there, borrowing some dispatch rider's motorbike, drove it over a low wall, frightened myself to death, and never sat on a motorbike again, except as a pillion passenger, when we went to places like Bath and so on in our spare time riding with this guy. It was really very enjoyable. And we went to Birmingham when he had a long 72-hour pass, as they were called. Went to Birmingham, saw his family's father manufactured interior sprung mattresses in a small factory, and flirted with his girlfriend, made him a bit jealous, and chatted to his mother, who said, oh yes, he loves his motorbike. He was very angry when he failed his test. And I had to go back with him to Warminster, knowing that he was driving without a license.
So that pretty well about it for Warminster. So you were there, and then you went
well,
to...
Well, I'll tell you, there was a visit from the one of the senior people, what they called a regional medical officer type of person. And he came around, and we'd got it all ready for his inspection. And he asked me a few questions, and I said that I was wanting to go to medical school. And he said, oh, you should be in a military hospital, and promptly posted me to the Wheatley Military Hospital in Oxford, which is where I went. To Hello. Captain G's delight and Captain Baird's displeasure.
And that's where we fall back into the story.
Yes.
So while you were at Wheatley Military Hospital on the ward, you were a corporal.
Yes.
Corporal orderly.
I was a corporal from the rest of the time.
Yeah.
I got up to full corporal somewhere along the line. Can't remember where. It must have been, when I was posted to the RCB in West Green, Wiltshire, the full corporal, two stripes, went with the rank, with the posting.
Now, after Wheatley Military Hospital, you went to
Hindhead in Surrey.
And what was that like?
That was a TB hospital, and also dermatology, where I did a lot of the dermatology. There was the CEO there was a chap called Edwards, Colonel Edwards. And there was an old prisoner of war hospital alongside it, which was populated by the RENC. And so they had lots and lots of private rooms just about. In the if you were an NCO, you could get a private room in this Nissen type prisoner of war hospital. And so that was great. Accommodation was marvellous. And what's more, the conditions were marvellous, because at Hindhead in Surrey, I suppose getting older, I met people who worked in theatre. They were all aspiring medical students, all had been accepted. I'd been accepted for Leeds at that time. And so we felt that we could approach other people of a superior class with a little more dignity, saying, you know, I'm going to Leeds University in October, was a nice opening thing, rather than just I'm doing my national service and I'm Group 252. And so I'd get to know the nursing sisters and so on. And we actually got as friendly as we could with them and played tennis and things like that, much to the displeasure of the old regulars, the REMC, who thought that this was breaching the class barriers, and promptly put the tennis court out of bounds. So we found other means of fraternization with the sisters.
Now tell me, how had you come to get accepted as a medical student at Leeds? I mean, when did you put your...
Right, I just kept applying to various places. I got an interview at Leeds, went up there. And
during your national service?
During my national service. As a fair number of people were. There were plenty of national servicemen about applying to medical school, about half a dozen in my year who'd done just that, including David Fletcher, who I met again. And we all got accepted and went up, and that's a bit of a tale hangs by that. I don't know whether I've got time to tell you. As I said, I knew there was a chap called Candy, who was an operating room assistant. And OTT, Operating Theatre Technician, was their official name. And there was another chap who I think his name was Page. He also was going to medical school. Candy was going to Bristol, and Page, I don't know where he was. We were the nucleus who flirted with the sisters and played tennis with them and got ourselves disliked by the regulars. But we'd also meet in the evening in the operating theatre and chat and so on and discuss lots of things, including the effect of anaesthetic drugs. Trilene was the anaesthetic drug that was used then, and there was plenty of it around. It wasn't controlled the way things are nowadays. So we learned a technique of turning the machine on, lying prone on the trolley or the operating theatre table, putting the mask against our faces and inhaling the trilene until we became unable to hold the mask when it fell away from our face, and we recovered and had a jolly good time until it all wore off. So it was a bit like Humphrey Davy's laughing gas parties that we had. And we decided it was probably a bit dangerous, and Corporal Candy, who was nominally in charge of theatre, said yes it was, and we ought never to do it again. And we all promised that each other that, you know, rather like Alcoholics Anonymous, that we would never do it again. And I remember he went out of the room for a while and came back, leaned against the wall, giggled and slid down to the floor. Having extracted this promise from us all, he went and promptly went and broke it himself.
So do you carried on doing it, or did you then?
No, we stopped. That was we realised that you know, the common sense of what he said, but it was rather amusing that he did the sort of last twist of it.
And so, anything else happened? I mean, what about your work there? You were doing the dermatology. I presume it was much the same as it had been at Wheatley.
Yes.
And what about the TB side? Did you have much to do with
it? Not much, no. The hospital dealt with tuberculosis and also dealt with syphilis. They used to, one of the ways in which they treated syphilis before penicillin was to heat up the body to the point of near death, and that would kill the germs, and then they would allow the chap to cool down, and that was had to be done in very controlled conditions, and there was a unit that did that.
And they were still doing it?
Maybe I don't recollect any in particular, but it was there. That was the unit for doing hyperthermia, as it was called, hyperthermic treatment. So it was a fairly specialised hospital. And
Were they getting on top of TB by then? With
penicillin? Yes, they were. It streptomycin had just been introduced, and so all these various techniques of treating people with collapse of the lungs and so on were going out. They would cut bits of the rib out and partially collapse the chest so as to reduce the activity of the lungs, and that meant it was less likely to bleed, and left on its own and quiet, it would recover, because it's not although it's a serious disease, it isn't a very damaging one, and the tendency is for the body to recover from it. So that's how sanatorium treatment and so on worked, by giving people nothing to do except get better.
But then penicillin just...
It's streptomycin, actually, not penicillin.
Sorry,
it's ineffective against... penicillin's ineffective against... But streptomycin, which was just being introduced then.
Now, anything else... That was your last hospital. Anything about Hindhead or any other...
Yes. In the same room that Corporal Candy disgraced himself, we all listened to the radio and Clement Attlee. I'll go back to Wheatley Military Hospital, if I may, just for a moment. Mm-hmm. Night ward master, one of the things we'd do, we'd saw the papers first. And I can remember very vividly opening the paper, and there was a headline about that big, which said, "War." And that rather shook me a bit. I turned pale. It was the war in Korea. And of course, we were all worried from then on as to what was going to happen to us. And
what were you worried might happen?
That we'd stay on. I was due for release. and I think that my release date was tinkered around with for a few days so that I could go to university. I'm due to release early in October. And I knew that if that was stopped, I'd be extended, because there was this talk of extension of national service in order to deal with the war in Korea. And Clement Attlee was going to make an announcement, which we all listened to. And I can really almost hear his voice now. And he's saying that release groups on 249, I think it was, onwards, are going to be stopped or recalled. Poor soul's had to come back. And made to serve an extra 6 months. Except those who already have university acceptance. We all breathed a sigh of relief, because we'd all been accepted by university. So there it was, went up like that, and I realized that it would be 249, yes. I'd be caught, and I wouldn't be able to get out. 249 had already gone, so I had 250, or certainly... no, maybe 250 hadn't gone. 249 had already gone home, said all they wanted to say to their various people they didn't like, and then they'd come back and make friends with them again. but Clement Attlee said those who already had university acceptance would be released as planned. So yeah. I escaped the Korean War by the skin of my teeth.
Was there any particular party on your release? That'd be
no, just left. In fact, I got myself into full service marching order, and I did that the night before. And the night orderly sergeant came round to make sure everybody was up, and he rattled my door, which was locked. And he said, "You mustn't lock your door." And I said, "Sergeant, I promise I shall never do it again." And since I never occupied the room again, I kept my promise.
Now, what about the demob? Was there a procedure? Did you get a demob suit or anything like that? Or were you just turned
Got out? Discharge papers. And we, as I say, I was in full service marching order. And I went to a camp at Aldershot, where I met some of the people that I'd met in my basic training, who were being released at the same time. And... there was a sort of minor reunion in a rather grim, tiny Nissen hut, where none of the requirements of, you know, barracks clean or anything. It was all in what we used to call shit order. And we were given, we handed in kit. And not all of it, some of it we had to take, because we weren't discharged. We were released into this compulsory part-time military service. So we had to retain certain things. And we were given our discharge papers and duly went home. It took about less than a fortnight.
Maybe. And that would be October 1951?
Yes, 1950. Wait a minute, 49, yes. April 49, October 49, October 50. And be, yes, that time.
October 1950.
Mm-hmm. Or the end of September, just a few days around then, because I think that term began on something like the 6th of October, and I was there for the beginning.
Now, we don't do your student time. You were a medical student for 6 years, weren't you?
Yes.
From October 50 to, I presume, July 50.
April 56, when I qualified.
April 56. Now, what was life like as a university student after being...
As I told you at the beginning, I hit the ground running. I couldn't wait to get started. And I was, the majority of them had come straight from school and had school attitudes. I felt much more mature, competent, focused on what I wanted to do, and got on and did it. But there were other people, ex-National Service, me, David Fletcher for one, Mike Hargreaves, who was another one, who was been in the RAF and troop ships, going back and forwards to Hong Kong.
You thought that your military service had given you an advantage then?
Very much so. I resented it when I had to go. I resented it while I was doing it. But I found once it was behind me, that it stood me in very good stead. I learned an awful lot about other people. I wasn't living in a sort of cloistered world of schoolboys and so on. And it was very easy to see what a cloistered world it was when you saw the schoolboys who came and were your cohort at medical school.
Had it given you a greater maturity? You'd be older, a year older than that.
Yes, I was 20 when I went to medical school. And
these
be 17 and a half, 18.
And that was an advantage as well.
I think it was an advantage, yes.
What about discipline and the things like that that had been instilled in you? Did that help with
I was always one for self-discipline anyway, from the sort of Boy Scout legacy where, the lessons that Baden-Powell tried to instill was self-reliance, self-discipline and so on. And I took to those very much. And was able to put them into practice not only in national service but also when I got to university. So university was no problem.
Now, can you just sketch out the nature of a medical course?
The way in which it differed, notably, and I wasn't aware of it at the beginning. First of all, there were no exemptions. You couldn't start. You had to start with basic maths, physics, and chemistry. In these, there were no exemptions from that. And I really quite enjoyed that, and for the very first time began to be excited by and comprehend mathematics, because it was explained by good lecturers who knew what they were talking about and could explain the relevance of mathematics to the other ideas that were around with natural history and so on. So I enjoyed that. And then there was anatomy and physiology, great detail anatomy, and that was a tremendous delight. To have an enormous number of facts, all of which I could soak up with my blotting paper memory. It's a bit like a sort of collector. You just soak it all up and I could trot it all out, and I was getting alphas and all that sort of thing for my examination results.
And the course covers all of medicine, does it? Or
yes, it's a general medical course. And after anatomy and physiology, you start to do clinical medicine. And in clinical medicine, the thing that made it, that revealed to me how different Leeds was and how very much superior it was to other medical schools at the time, was that they sent you straight onto the wards. Whereas I took up fencing as one of the pastimes at the university. David Fletcher and I both were fencers, and we were on the team, and we would meet other members from various teams, including various other medical schools. And we discovered that we'd be first-year medical students, first-year clinical students who'd already done our anatomy physiology, first-year clinical students, and we'd spend a year working in the hospital on the wards at everybody's beck and call, doing all kinds of dog's body things and learning things all the time. Practical things, talking to patients, taking histories. All of the sort of things that you would, like an apprenticeship. And we were fencing with people who were in the same stage as us in medical school, and they'd never even seen a patient. They'd been sort of introduced into this sort of dry academic side of medicine, whereas we were thrown straight. We had to live in the hospital for a week at a time as what were called dressers, and we were given accommodation, and it was before the days of all this mobile communication. There were in corridors and wards there were bells, and it's very Victorian. The Leeds General Infirmary was designed by Gilbert Scott, and looked a bit like St. Pancras Station displaced elsewhere. And they had these bells, and they were coded so that the number of bells rang told you whether it was clinical dressers, medical dressers, surgical housemen, medical housemen, and so on. You'd listen to these bells, ding, 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 and then go along to the front door where the porter told you where you were wanted.